Chapter 2. The morning after the ball, Jane skips up the two steps from her bedroom to the landing and rushes down the narrow staircase into the kitchen, then hops up to enter the family parlour. Steventon Rectory is a higgledy-piggledy construction, its very layout revealing the history of a dwelling haphazardly thrown together over the previous two centuries. Jane dressed with haste, in terror that Tom might be an early riser. Surely he will call on her today. His declaration was sorely interrupted, and he must be as desperate for her answer as she is to hear the terms of his proposal. God forbid he should complete the mile and a half walk from Ash Rectory, where he is staying with his uncle, the Reverend George Lefroy, before Jane is ready to receive him. Several chestnut tendrils escape from Jane's plait, and the laces of her canary-yellow gown hang loose. Sally, the Austin's maid, hums softly as she places a tray of dirty crockery on the table and moves to assist Jane with her drawstring neckline. Within the parlour, the whole family are gathered, and a blaze burns in the red brick fireplace. In the centre of the room, Jane's mother, Mrs. Cassandra Austin, sits at an old-fashioned cherrywood table, covered with a plain linen cloth and laid for breakfast. Mrs. Austin holds steady a wooden bowl of stewed apples as Anna, James's infant daughter, leans precariously out of her high chair to get at it with a spoon. Mr. George Austin, Jane's father, studies yesterday's newspaper, which a kindly neighbour drops off once he's finished with it. James reads a different section of the same broadsheet. Mr. Austin has divided the newspaper in half, allowing James to pursue the advertisements and the gossip while he scrutinises the naval reports for any mention of His Majesty's ships, Glory and Daedalus. Both vessels were last reported off the coast of the West Indies, and each carries the extremely precious cargo of a younger Austin boy. 21-year-old Frank and 16-year-old Charles are both on active service with the Royal Navy. Technically, as his father's curate for the nearby village of Overton, James has his own home. But since the tragic and wholly unexpected death of his young wife, earlier in the year, he's found solace in returning to the nest. He may sleep and preach in Overton, but he takes his meals and leaves his laundry at Steventon. 18-month-old Anna is always at Steventon, in the care of her grandmother. It used to break Jane's heart when she cried for her mama. It is almost worse now that she has stopped doing so. "I'll have that, thank you." Mrs. Austin prizes open Anna's chubby fist to remove a small glass medicine bottle. "Who left it lying about?" Sally dips in apology as she tucks the bottle into the folds of her apron. Jane doesn't point out that it was Mrs. Austin who had left the medicine on the table. Sally was already in bed by the time Jane got home and broke the news of the horrific incident to her enraptured parents. Mrs. Austin had retrieved the bottle from the locked medicine cabinet and all but forced a drop of laudanum on Jane for the shock. Jane had clamped her lips shut and stoutly refused the tincture. Her wit is the sharpest weapon in her armory. She will not have it blunted. When Tom calls, and surely he will call today, he'll ask Jane to make the most important decision in a young woman's life. Perhaps the only important decision she'll ever make by herself. How could she have faced such a prospect had her mind been reeling from the after effects of a laudanum-induced haze? "Did I miss Henry?" Jane pulls out a chair, scraping the wooden feet over the quarry-tiled floor. The walls of the snug room are lime-washed and adorned with hoarse brasses and cross-stitched samplers, which do little to absorb the noise of her rowdy family. James nods as he shakes out his half of the paper. He shot off back to Oxford first thing this morning. Henry is a student, another Hampshire lad destined for the clergy. But with the imminent threat of an invasion from the Jacobins from across the Channel, he's volunteered for the militia. Being Henry, he's somehow arranged for his regiment to be stationed just outside Oxford, allowing him to continue his studies while simultaneously serving king and country. "That's a shame. I wanted to talk to him before he went." Jane pours herself some tea from the black basalt teapot. She hasn't slept well. Every time she closed her eyes, Madame Renault's sunken cheeks and gaping mouth appeared, as if her death mask was imprinted on Jane's eyelids. As a rector's daughter, she's seen plenty of corpses. The poor of the parish cannot afford their own coffins. They arrive for their funerals wrapped in their shrouds, borrow the communal box for the service, then are tipped out of it into the freshly dug earth to be buried. From the window of the stagecoach, she's even seen the remains of highwaymen, wrapped in chains and suspended from gibbets at the crossroads. Their decaying bodies, oozing with maggots and swarmed by flies, are prominently displayed near the scene of their crimes.